I saw so many familiar faces, neighbors, as well as kids from my old school, now scrapping with one another to carry luggage or pour tea. I spotted my friend Peter, still selling cold drinks.
Martin! He shouted as I waved to him. Where have you been?
I told him about Nyanga and how I was hoping to go to university in the United States. I'm headed to the passport office right now, friend, I said.
You're on your way to great places, he said.
From your lips to God's ears, I said, offering him my fist, which he tapped with his. The passport office opened at 9 o'clock, and I expected a long line, so I took an 8:05 a.m. bus. Shockingly, I was the only one there. I entered the squat cement building that looked more like a bunker than an official government office. I am here to collect my passport, I told the receptionist.
Right this way, she said.
I followed her into another room, where a man in a navy suit asked me for my birth certificate and the letter that stated my passport was ready for pickup. I produced both, and he handed me my passport within 5 minutes. I stood there, holding this small green book, waiting for more instructions.
Is there anything else, sir? I asked.
No, that is all, he said. Clearly, Mr. Muzawazi's assistance had worked. My travel documents were in order, my family was doing okay, thanks to Caitlin and her family, and I even had a friend going to the US leading the way for me. The only worry I had was that I had been doing quite a lot of thinking about pursuing medicine. The images of those people waiting online at the hospital haunted me and often kept me awake at night. I wanted to help my fellow countrymen, but had grown concerned that I did not have the stomach for it. I loved numbers and was good at them, and so I decided to pursue actuarial science. I wanted Caitlin to know this immediately, as she was putting great effort into finding me scholarships at medical schools. I knew she'd understand. She had recently written me about changing her career focus to nursing. That gave me the courage to shift my own course. As I walked toward the exit, I flipped through the many blank pages in this pocket-sized book waiting to be filled. I couldn't wait to get home and write to Caitlin.
September 2002. Caitlin. Martin had only ever mentioned his family in letters before, so Wallace stood out. That he was actually coming to the United States was beyond thrilling. If Wallace could do it, Martin could too. The only problem was, Martin did not mention which school Wallace was going to. We'd have to wait for Wallace to get in touch. The thought made me giddy. It was an exciting time for me. I'd just started my dual enrollment program. That semester, I had signed up for 5 college classes. English 101, General Psychology, History, Liberal Arts, and Calculus, which I dropped quickly. I still hated math, but I liked being surrounded by older students who wanted to be there. It was so different from high school. I'd always gravitated toward older kids. Damon was a year older than me, as was Heather, my neighbor. She had left for college, and I missed her. But Damon was still around. He wasn't interested in college, though, and couldn't understand why I was.
"Why don't you just work more shifts at the pizza joint?" he asked earlier that summer.
He'd started working full-time at a factory in nearby Sellersville that made unfinished furniture. People could paint the chairs or dressers any color they wanted. He was happy doing that, but I wanted more out of my life than waitressing could afford me. I started to worry that he wanted me to be more like his mother. She married his father young and gave up any plans for college or a career to take care of her husband. Even though his father was disabled, he ruled the house. His mother jumped when his father said so. That was not the life I wanted for myself. I worked every Wednesday and Saturday at the pizza parlor, and spent every spare moment in between doing homework. I never cared about it in the past, but I loved college and wanted to do well. It wasn't easy, and it left hardly any time to hang out with Damon. When I started studying with Jeremy, an older guy in my English class, Damon got jealous.
One night, he called me 4 times in a 2-hour period. I was studying for my very first psych exam and didn't want to be bothered. By the 4th call, I thought it must be serious. "Is everything okay?" I said, instead of hello.
"Why haven't you been answering my calls?" he said angrily.
"I told you I was studying," I said, wishing I had not picked up.
"You're always studying," he said. "It's bullshit."
"Actually, it's my future," I said, incensed. "You giving me a hard time about it is bullshit." I stayed on the phone listening to his rants for 15 minutes, and then simply said, "I'm not going to argue with you about this. I have a test tomorrow. If you really love me, you would want me to do well." And then I hung up. The next day, I aced my psychology test.
September 2002. Matin. Back at Nianga, 2 emails were waiting for me. One was from the SAT board telling me I was registered for the December 7th test date in Harare. It was happening. My heart was racing as I opened the second email. That was from Wallace. He hadn't been able to get in touch with Caitlin or Anne. "As for the email addresses you gave me," he wrote, "it is a pity that none of them actually works. I tried them all, but to no avail. Could you do me a favor by sending them to me one more time? I might have missed the spelling or phrasing." I emailed him back immediately to let him know my SAT exam date was set and to confirm Anne's email address. I wanted to write a PS that I would see him very soon. That I would one day be an African student studying in the United States like him. But I decided to wait. I did not want to jinx it.
October 2002. Caitlin. Richie went to visit Temple University in Philadelphia that September and decided he wanted to transfer there in January.
"It seems like a super fun school," he said.
"Fun does not necessarily mean good," my mom said.
"Or pay the bills," my father added.
"Geez," Richie interjected.
"I was also going to say that they have all the marketing courses I need to finish my degree."
"That sounds more like it," Mom said. Ever since Richie got pulled out of college for choosing partying over studying, my parents had been giving him a hard time. The rule in our house was that you get one opportunity to screw up. Richie was still living at home because he had not figured out his best next step, and he knew he couldn't mess that one up. I kept quiet. It irked my brother that I was taking freshman classes at the same community college where he had just finished his sophomore year. Earlier that week, I teased him that if he didn't focus, I'd graduate before him.
"That will never happen," he said through clenched teeth.
I knew better than to push any further. A few days later, my mom finally got an email from Wallace. Neither of us could believe where he was studying. Temple University.
"Richie was just there," my mom said excitedly. "He could have taken him out to lunch if we had known."
"He may have walked right by him," I said, getting goosebumps at the thought. It felt like a sign, and we needed one. Mom was still gunning for Villanova for Martin, but had also sent at least a dozen requests for scholarships to nearby schools. One had offered $14,000, half of what Martin needed. This was promising. Colleges were at least interested in sponsoring Martin, but we needed a full ride. "Maybe Wallace will have ideas," I said to my mom as she was going down her list.
"My thought exactly," she said.
She was planning to visit him the very next day. I was sad I couldn't join her. My schedule was so full, I barely had time to see her, let alone drive back and forth to Philly in the middle of a school week. We already agreed that this would be the first of many visits. My best friend lived 10,000 miles away from me, and his close friend just happened to get into a school 45 minutes away from our house. The next night,
I was up in my room studying when I heard my mom's car pull into the driveway. I ran down the stairs. She had barely opened the door when I started pummeling her with questions.
How was it? I asked. Did you take any photos? What's he like? Did he tell you about Martin?
Why do you want to know? She teased. Mom, I said, I need to know everything. She told me that she arrived at his dorm room and was stunned to find his side practically empty. His roommate had a comforter and matching sheets, posters on the wall, and a computer set up on his side of the room, my mom said. And Wallace had nothing, not even a pillow or sheets. Her description reminded me of the photos Martin sent of his family. I wondered if Wallace's family was too poor to buy him things as well. I don't think he knew what he was getting himself into, my mom said. So I made a list. My mom spent a week gathering things on her list, and by Friday morning had several shopping bags brimming with linens, clothes, and toiletries. We'd deliver them that night. The day dragged on. My last class ended at 3:15. I watched the clock throughout the 90-minute lecture, convinced it was broken. It took forever for the bell to ring. Damon wanted to come as well. I wish I could say it was because he was sincerely interested in meeting Martin's dear friend. Honestly, I think he was just being protective and even a bit jealous. Dad came home early from work, and we all piled in Mom's Jeep Cherokee. My family rarely went to Philadelphia, so it always felt like an adventure. Temple was like a mini-city itself. As we walked toward the dorm, we saw college-aged kids hanging out on building stoops, smoking cigarettes, or playing hacky sack. It was Friday evening, so everyone was in a good mood. The security guard called up to Wallace's room to say he had visitors. And within minutes, Wallace emerged through a door tentatively. He walked toward us, with his shoulders hunched around his ears, his neck disappearing into his polo shirt like a turtle about to retreat.
How do you do? He said, extending his hand toward me.
I'm Caitlin, I said, bursting inside, like I swallowed a firecracker.
Yes, I know, he said. Martin has showed me your photos.
I couldn't contain myself. I threw my arms around Wallace and said, It's so amazing to meet you.
I felt his body stiffen, so I pulled back to introduce him to Damon and my dad, each of whom were holding two huge shopping bags.
We've already met, my mom said, opening her arms to give Wallace another hug. She must have felt his body tense up too, because she said, Wallace, one thing you'll learn about us quickly is that we're huggers. His eyes grew wide, and he let out a nervous laugh before saying,
That is fine. Would you like to see my room?
Lead the way, my dad said. And Wallace, I'd like to clarify, the women are huggers in my family. When I set these bags down, I'll give you a proper handshake.
Good, Wallace said, sounding relieved. We entered his room to find his roommate lying on his bed, listening to his Discman. He barely acknowledged us, or Wallace, as he rolled off the bed and walked out the door. I could tell from that short interaction that he was a total jerk. Mom wasn't exaggerating. His side of the room was totally set up. He had tapestries on one wall and photos of his grungy friends back in Seattle on his desk. His closet door was open and stuffed with clothes. I opened Wallace's closet and saw that he had exactly two pairs of pants, neatly folded on a shelf, and two hanging shirts. My mom started unpacking bags. Damon, unwrap the comforter, she said. Rich, the rug goes there. Wallace, this is an alarm clock. Do you know how to use one? I started hanging up the new clothes she bought for him, and was relieved to see that she had brought hangers as well. Meanwhile, Wallace stood in the center of the room saying, Thank you, over and over again.
You don't need to thank us, my mom said. Martin is like our son. And since you're his friend, that means you are part of our extended family as well.
Wallace bowed his head and said thank you again. How are things going at school? I said, hoping to get him to open up.
Fine, he said. Have you made any new friends? I asked.
Not yet, he said.
The entire conversation consisted of me asking questions and Wallace offering one- and two-word answers. At least I was trying. Damon stood in the corner of Wallace's room with his arms crossed. I wished he had just stayed home. Within 30 minutes, Wallace's side of the room felt at least lived in, and my mom was making him try on the winter coat she found on sale at Ross.
It snows here, you know, she said.
Have you ever seen snow?
Damon finally asked a question.
No,
Wallace said.
But I'm very excited to do so.
An 8-word answer, I thought. He's opening up.
I'm starving, my dad announced. Let's go eat.
We had already chosen the Hard Rock Cafe in downtown Philly because it was typical American food and only a short distance from the campus. I had never been, so I was excited. We walked to the car, where I squeezed in the middle between Wallace and Damon. On our way to the restaurant, I interrogated Wallace about Martin.
He's very smart, Wallace said, and so funny.
I knew it, I exclaimed. I can tell from his letters.
Did you know Martin is from the bush? Wallace said.
I thought he was from Mutare, I said.
He grew up there, but his people are from very rural areas, Wallace said. Mine are too.
Just then, my dad pulled into a parking lot by the historic Reading train station where the Hard Rock Cafe was located. As we got out of the car, I wondered how many other things I did not know about Martin. Inside the restaurant, Houghton here was blaring on the speakers so loudly that the crystal chandeliers shook above us as we followed the hostess to the purple leather banquette reserved for our party. I slipped in first and told Wallace to sit next to me. Damon made a sour face, like he'd bit into a lemon. I didn't care. I could talk to him whenever I wanted. Wallace was the only person I was interested in that night. Our waitress appeared with menus. She was wearing a short-sleeve shirt, which exposed the elaborate artwork that covered both of her arms. I noticed Wallace's eyes widen as she passed him a menu. I leaned in and explained, "Those are tattoos." The space between his eyes crinkled. Then, he opened his menu and looked startled. I understood why. There were 3 columns of different dishes per page.
"Order whatever you want," Damon said, finally trying to be nice.
"Do you like cheeseburgers?" my dad asked.
"I've never had one, sir," Wallace responded.
Everyone laughed at our table, except Wallace.
"Well, there's a first time for everyone," my dad said.
I pointed at the list of cheeseburgers. There were more than 20 to choose from. Wallace's eyes grew glassy. "Do you want me to order for you?" I asked.
"Actually, I'm not very hungry," he said. "I had a late lunch."
"We'll order a bunch of different things, and you can try whatever you want."
"That sounds fine," he said, closing the menu.
After we placed our order, I continued grilling Wallace. "How tall is Martin? What's his best subject? Does he have a girlfriend?" Wallace knew all of the answers.
"Quite short. Math, and no, not to my knowledge," Wallace said. "Nyanga is an all-boys school."
Our food order covered the entire table. The cheeseburgers took up half the plate, and the French fries spilled over the sides. A slice of tomato was as large as the hamburger patty itself. Even I was shocked by the excess. Wallace had a bite of a cheeseburger and tried a French fry and an onion ring. I think he liked all of it,
but I could not tell if he was just being polite. My mom asked for all the leftovers to be boxed.
You can take it back to your dorm room, my mom said.
That's not necessary,
Wallace said.
I insist, my mom countered.
I don't have anywhere to keep it, he responded.
That's why we're going to get you a mini-fridge after dinner, my mom said.
That was news to all of us, including my dad. We got back into the car and drove to the nearest Sears, where we purchased a refrigerator the size of a large TV set. Back on campus, we set up Wallace's new fridge and then filled it with food once it was plugged in and humming. Just then, his roommate walked in.
Whoa, he said.
Yeah, whoa, I responded. Then, I turned to Wallace and said,
Anything you need, just call us.
My mom added, In fact, we already set up the spare room in the basement and would love for you to come spend a weekend.
I'll come pick you up, my dad said.
I gave Wallace a hug goodbye and then glared at his roommate as I walked out the door. I was so angry that he had not done more to make Wallace feel welcome. But then, I heard my mom behind me, and my heart swelled.
We'll see you soon, Wallace, she said. Just think of us as your American family.
October 2002. Martin. Wallace emailed to say he had finally connected with Caitlin and her family.
Wow, he wrote. What nice people.
I laughed out loud in the quiet dark of Mr. Muzawazi's office. So very true, I thought. I was gathering all of my teacher recommendation letters to send to Caitlin's mom. My physics teacher and guidance counselor each wrote a letter for me, as did the headmaster. The first one I received was from Mr. Makunura, my chemistry teacher, who had handed me his letter the day after my request. It looked so official, typed on Marist Brothers stationery. Class was just about to start, but my curiosity was strong. I quickly scanned the letter. Academically, Martin is an outstanding student, the letter began. I looked around quickly to make sure no one saw what I was doing. It would be embarrassing to be caught reading about myself. I couldn't stop. He mentioned my O-level scores and said that I was in the top 5% of my A-level class. He spoke about my academic achievements at Nyanga, but then he wrote something that made me feel so proud. Given his intellectual capability and motivation, I feel strongly that he will successfully go through the challenging course he has chosen. Martin is an exceptional student, one of the best I have come across. Mr. Makunura had started his lecture, so I quickly placed the letter in my folder and started to take notes, unable to contain the smile that was stretching clear across my face. I'd always called Caitlin's parents Mr. and Mrs. Stoichitz. But when Caitlin wrote me a letter in which she explained that her parents were informal and that most of her friends called them by their first names, Rich and Anne, she added, You're not like most of my friends. You're more like family. So my parents would like you to consider them your parents from another country. I hope that is okay. I flipped through all the letters that Anne had sent me and the dozens of emails I had printed. In one she sent in September, she listed the more than 20 universities she already contacted on my behalf. On October 1st, she wrote, Are you tired of me yet? And then went on to detail her efforts at new schools, including Drexel, Villanova, and Franklin and Marshall. On October 2nd, she sent another note recommending I email a woman at a college in Pennsylvania as they offered full funding for superior students. And then the very next day, she sent another email in which she wrote, Martin! LaSalle University! Her father had gone there, and they offered full scholarships. She signed off with, I have a good feeling about this one. I had never seen so many exclamation points in one email. Her enthusiasm was contagious. Attached to that email was information about the Christian Brothers Scholarship. It read, These scholarships cover full tuition and fees. Only 16 are awarded each year. The average SAT score is 1350. I suddenly understood the importance of these SAT tests. and that Anne was doing for me what a mother does for her own child. So on October 15th, when I sent Anne and Rich my recommendation letters and my personal essay, I addressed their company note, "Dear Mom and Dad." It didn't feel strange writing such intimate words to people I had not yet met. On the contrary, it felt right. I ended the letter with, "I love you." It looked spare on the page, not as robust as I wanted it to come across. So I drew a big heart around it. That looked much better.
November 2002. Caitlin. Wallace came to visit the last weekend in October, and then every weekend after that. I could tell he was really having a hard time adjusting to life at Temple. "At Marist, we study on the weekends," Wallace told us that first day. "But at Temple, everyone just wants to get drunk. I don't understand it." Richie laughed. "Your way is better, Wallace," he said. "Trust me."
"I think so too, but my roommate says it's why I'm having difficulties finding friends," Wallace said. My hatred of his roommate grew deeper that day. "Do what you think is right," my mom chimed in. "You will meet people who feel the same way." I wasn't so sure. Wallace seemed so lost. I realized that we had to carefully choose the right place for Martin. Wallace seemed more introverted than Martin, but I still wanted to make sure that Martin went to a school that would welcome him. No one at Temple seemed to care that Wallace had come all the way from Zimbabwe to study there. That really upset me. It also reminded me of all the times my high school friends teased me about Martin. I wanted to shake all those idiots by their shoulders and shout, "You are missing an amazing opportunity right now!" People are so scared of what they don't know. It's a terrible mistake. Mom invited Wallace to spend Thanksgiving with our family, and we took lots of pictures to send to Martin. It was during that long weekend when we realized how badly Wallace was struggling. By then, Richie had been accepted to Temple to start in January. Since he was planning to commute to school and could drive Wallace back and forth, my parents invited Wallace to move in with us until we could find him better accommodations and a nicer roommate. I wrote Martin to tell him the news and to wish him luck on the SAT exams. I knew he was scheduled to take them on December 7th in Harare. I bombed mine, but it didn't matter. For Martin, these tests were crucial. "Break a leg," I wrote as my PS. Just in case he didn't understand what that meant, I added, "That's American for good luck."
December 2002. Matin. We sat for final exams that November in Nianga and had to wait until January for the results. We would all be back home by then. There was no graduation at Maris Brothers. Instead, Mr. Muzawazi hosted a final party in early December. Most of my friends were headed to Harare for university that January. A few were going to England, and one guy was going to Canada. Two others had applied for early admission to American colleges and had been accepted. I was the only one without a definite plan. While my friends all had their places secured, they also had opinions for where I should go. "Harvard is the place," Bonaventure said. "I hear Princeton is even better," Cornelius countered. They were both planning to study medicine at the University of Zimbabwe. At the party, they weighed all the pros and cons of my options. Brown, UPenn, Stanford, Villanova. "Guys," I said, interrupting their fun, "I'd be happy at any of these places. I just need one to say yes to a full scholarship." Both my friends fell silent. They understood how high the stakes were. I had not applied anywhere else. If none of the U.S. colleges worked out, I'd have to rethink everything. Before I left Nianga for good, I went to Harare to take the SATs. My American mother had arranged everything. She paid up front for the exam and then wired me money to the local bank in Nianga so I had enough for the bus ticket and pocket money. I stayed with Alois and Sekai the night before the exam. I hadn't seen them since they helped me get into Marist. I arrived at the test site 45 minutes early. I had been awake all night. Whether it was from nerves or excitement, I didn't know. But I knew taking this important test on no sleep could be a problem. I watched nervously as 24 or more students entered the room. All of them came from wealthy families. I could tell by their shoes. The test was more difficult than I had anticipated. I had never taken an exam like that and worried I did not do well. The verbal section was very challenging. I struggled through it, but then I shook that thought from my head. There was no time to doubt. I took the bus back to Nianga to gather my things and then continued on to Mutare the next day. Before I left that majestic campus, I popped in to see Mr. Muzawazi for the last time as a Marist Brothers student. I was among the last students to leave, so the campus was void of the usual hum of student life. I knocked on his door and heard the thumps echo through the great hall I had first walked 2 years earlier. "Enter," Mr. Muzawazi's voice boomed from the other side. I opened the door and saw him sitting behind his desk. Finally, instead of having to convince him of anything, I simply wanted to thank him. "Sir, if it weren't for you, I'd be stuck in Chisamba Singles," I explained. "Martin," he interrupted me, "you don't get stuck." "I try not to, sir," I said. "But you do succeed," he replied. "I wish you continued success wherever you land." "Thank you, sir," I said, bowing as I backed out of his office. "And don't forget to keep in touch," his voice bellowed down the hallway after me. Back home, I made daily trips to the only internet cafe in Mutare to keep up my correspondence with Anne and Caitlin. Now with my A-levels and SATs behind me, I could concentrate on college admissions 100%. Part 6. American Dream.
January 2003. Caitlin. Martin's SAT scores were sent to my mother's email address in mid-January. He did not do as well as we had hoped. "In an ideal world, these tests don't matter," she said. "But our world isn't ideal, and this is bad news." "They cannot be worse than mine," I said. "That would be impossible," my mom deadpanned. "But seriously, yours did not matter. His mean everything. He got an 1100, which is great for a kid from Chisamba Singles, but not good enough to get him that full scholarship to LaSalle." "What are we going to do?" I asked. "We need a new plan," she said. "We brainstormed ways to raise money for Martin. You will write the U.S. Embassy in Harare, and I will get in touch with Mr. Muzawazi," Mom said. "Two schools have already offered partial scholarships. Maybe we can get a Zimbabwean sponsor to do the rest." I had a contact at the U.S. Embassy already, from when we were trying to figure out where Martin could take the SATs in Zimbabwe. Her name was Rebecca Ziegler-Mano. It was 10:30 p.m. in the U.S., but I wanted her to read this as soon as she got to work the next day. I reminded her who I was and my relationship to Martin, and then I cut straight to the point. "We are searching desperately for scholarship money for Martin. My parents have two of us in college presently and are unable to take on the burden of a third tuition. They have paid all his application fees and arranged for him to take his SATs as well as forward those results to many different schools. They have currently spent over $1,000 and countless hours trying to help Martin receive a U.S. education. But scholarships, both merit and need-based, are rare." I asked her if she had any contacts or thoughts whatsoever as to who might be willing to help sponsor Martin. I signed off with, "Any help would be appreciated," and then hit send. I heard the whoosh sound that emails make when they are soaring off into cyberspace and imagined a letter folded into an airplane shape, leaving Hatfield and landing on Rebecca's desk in Harare within minutes. Then, I switched off the computer and bowed my head in prayer. "Dear God,
Please help me find a way to bring Martin to the United States. I made the sign of the cross and hoped God would not think badly of me for suddenly turning to him at this moment. We needed all the help we could muster.
January 2003. Martin. My SAT scores arrived first, and they were not nearly as high as I had hoped. This was bad news. I had one last chance. The SAT, too, was in mid-January, which was another version of the test, and so a second chance to do well. I took that, and then I stayed on in Harare for another week to gather information about applying for an American visa. I was also awaiting my A-level results, which came around the same time. Finally, some good news. I received 2 A's, one in math, one in chemistry, and 1 B for physics. I took these results to the Ministry of Education to apply for a temporary teaching position, a popular thing to do for students who don't go straight to university. I wouldn't hear from American schools until April at the earliest, and even then, I wouldn't have to leave until August. That meant I had 8 months to start making money. "We have an immediate opening for a science teacher," the minister told me the afternoon of my appointment. "Great," I said. "Where?" "Chigodora," he replied. I'd never heard of such a place. "It's 4 hours west of Mutare and another 4 hours south of Marundera," he explained. "One school services a dozen or more villages. You'll be a great asset to your students." I thought of Rabbit, who had come from the rural areas and was just starting his second year at medical school. "I'll do it," I said. The pay was nominal, but enough to cover my basic expenses. I signed the paperwork that afternoon. "Report as soon as possible," the minister said. "They've been waiting for a science teacher for 2 years now." I shook his hand. It felt good knowing I might have something useful to offer those less fortunate than I. Before I left Harare, I popped into an internet cafe to let Caitlin and Anne know I'd be teaching in an area where there was surely no internet, let alone electricity. I promised to keep in touch through letters. I also sent Anne the list of things I needed for my visa. I knew this was premature, but I decided it was better to plan ahead. I added, "Well, this time, I feel I did quite well on the SAT too. I think I made it this time. I love you all. I can't wait to be on US soil." And then I signed off with my new favorite goodbye, a string of X's and O's that Caitlin had recently taught me was American for hugs and kisses.
February 2003. Caitlin. Rebecca Ziegler-Mano responded the very next day. She promised to keep her eyes open for opportunities, but made it clear that she did not expect any to present themselves. "The economic troubles in this country are dismal," she wrote. I did not have the heart to share that news with Martin, especially since his last email to our family was so hopeful. The line, "I can't wait to be on U.S. soil," made me tense up. What if we couldn't pull this off? My mom was still waiting to hear from Mr. Muzawazi. She had sent him a similar request for Zimbabwean sponsors, thinking perhaps the Delta Corporation that sponsored Martin for Marist would be willing to do the same for an American university. He responded on January 30th. My mother showed me the email, and I understood why she looked so defeated. "I hope all will be well with Martin. He is a committed and hard-working student with outstanding performance in mathematics. Unfortunately, our contacts from here are limited, and there is no one that we can recommend to assist Martin. The economic situation is very difficult." Dismal and difficult were the words swirling through my head that February as we waited for universities to respond to his application. Meanwhile, Damon continued to pester me about the amount of time I was spending on my college courses. I finally lost it one night. He started picking on me again for not being able to go bowling with him and his friends on a Thursday night. "It's a school night, Damon," I said. "I have homework."
"Just blow it off," he responded. "It's no big deal."
dismal, and desperate, started whipping around in my brain like empty plastic bags in a wind tunnel.
"It's a huge deal!" I shouted,
stunned by how loud and angry my voice sounded.
"I know I can blow it off, but I don't want to." "What's your problem?" he said. "Seriously?" I asked. "You know how hard my mom and I are working to find Martin a scholarship. You know how upset I am at the thought that he may not be able to come to the United States to study and fulfill his dreams."
"Oh, Jesus, not Martin again," he said. "I'm so sick of your pen pal."
I saw red.
"Well, guess what, Damon? I'm so sick of you,"
I was shouting again.
"Leave Martin out of this. It's not about him. It's about me. I don't give you a hard time for not wanting more out of your life, so why are you constantly criticizing me?"
"You used to be more fun," he said quietly. "I miss that Caitlin."
"Well, that Caitlin has grown up," I said, retaining my composure. "And she cares more about college than bowling." I held back from adding, "And you." I knew Damon was under a lot of pressure. His dad had taken a turn for the worse. There was talk that he would not live more than a few years. I didn't judge Damon for deciding to stick close to home, but I was certainly not going to let him judge me or hold me back.
April 2003. Matin. Chigodora was even more rural than Nyanga. The bus dropped me off at a small lean-to on the side of a dirt road. There was no town anywhere in sight. I saw smoke up in the distance and followed a path that led me to a small mud hut with a thatched roof. Two women were tending a fire, wearing only a scrap of material around their waists. Several children ran around nearly naked as well. Few had shorts on, and none had shoes. "Manheru," I said, "good evening," in Shona. The sun was about to set and I was eager to get settled. I introduced myself as the new science teacher and one of the elder boys ran to fetch someone who could lead me to the school. He returned with an older man whose hair had gone completely white. He too was wearing just a pair of tattered shorts, nothing else. Poverty in the country was even more brutal than what I experienced growing up. At least in the cities, there were cast-offs of wealthier people, whether used clothes or leftover food. But in Chigodora, there was nothing to cast off. The older man asked me to follow him past a few more mud huts, much like the first one I had encountered. Finally, we arrived at the school, which was at least made of concrete. It had one room, with several desks and chairs that were so rickety and old, I thought it might be better to teach outdoors. There I met Frank, a teacher who was a few years older than me and had gotten his degree at Africa University, just outside of Mutare. He had arrived a few weeks earlier to teach history and invited me to stay with him. We went back to his place, another mud hut not far from the school. When I finally lay down on the packed earth floor beneath a roof that smelled like damp hay, I understood why my mother moved to Chisamba Singles. It was an upgrade. That night, I dreamed of my mother as a young girl. When I woke up the next morning, I thought someone as smart as her could be in my classroom. That made me excited to meet my students. Frank was already tending the fire when I emerged from the hut. He offered me tea and some of his mealy meal. I was very thankful, not only for the food, but also for his company. I had so many questions for him, starting with, "Where can I bathe?" He pointed down a dirt path. "There is a stream down that way," he said. "I prefer to bathe at the end of the day after the sun has warmed the water a bit." He told me this was also the place to fetch drinking water. So I grabbed a bucket and went on an exploratory mission. If this was my home for the next 8 months, I had better get used to it. I reported to the school an hour later and was excited to see a few students already there. Every school in Zimbabwe requires a uniform, and most of the kids in Chigodora had some semblance of one. One young boy, maybe 14, was wearing rags stitched together to resemble shorts. Another girl had a shirt that was several sizes too small. Clearly she'd been wearing it for years.
My family was fortunate by comparison. I introduced myself and told my students how I got there. I could tell by their faces that they were impressed. None of these kids had ever left Shigodora, let alone visited Mutare. That was the big city for them. I went around the room and asked everyone to tell me his or her name and where each lived and what their parents did for a living. Enough went first. She lived 7 kilometers away.
I wake every morning at 4 to help my father with the cows, she said. I'm the eldest of 5 girls, so my mother needs me to prepare breakfast and clean the dishes before I can leave for school.
How long does it take you to get here? I asked.
If I run, I can do it in 40 minutes, she said.
Givemore went next. I stay with my grandmother, he said. I had to take time off from school when my mother fell ill to care for her. I'm still catching up. This explained why he looked my age or older. I didn't ask what I knew to be true, that his mother no longer was alive. The stories continued, each one as difficult as the next, though none of these kids thought so. To them, this was normal. I started teaching that same day and saw how hungry they were for this knowledge. Givemore stayed after school that day, and everyone thereafter, wanting to borrow my books and to take more notes. You remind me of myself, I said after several weeks. He was clever and hardworking. The biggest difference was that he had no support. After 2 months, I learned I had no support either. Frank and I would take the bus to Mutare every Friday to spend the weekends with our families and check our bank accounts. We'd head back Sunday night, dejected.
Nothing,
I'd say as I boarded the bus to Chigodora. Me either, Frank said. Our salaries were already meager, just enough to cover food and bus fare and not much else. But neither of us had been paid since we started, which meant we both had to pay out of pocket to teach. I wanted to stay for my students' sake, but I could not afford to. Frank felt the same way, but he didn't have any prospects to return to in Mutare. Plus, he was older than me, which meant all of the women in the village wanted him to marry their eligible daughters. While food was scarce, Frank and I never went hungry. The villagers, despite their poverty, took great care of us. Leaving was a very difficult decision for me. I knew that college acceptances would start coming in, and I needed to be accessible. I also had to focus on securing a scholarship. On one of my visits home, I learned that Temple University was one of the first places to offer me a place for September 2003, but they could only offer $12,000, which was not even half the tuition. The same happened with 3 other colleges I had applied to. This was good news. At least I was getting accepted. I just needed proper funding. My last day of school was in April, right before the first break. My announcement was met with an eerie silence. I was not the first to abandon these students. Givemore stayed after school that day to speak with me one last time. I just wanted to thank you, he said. For what? I asked. For coming, he said, and for giving me hope.
April 2003. Caitlin. All of Martin's college correspondence was being sent to me, so I started checking the mailbox every afternoon that spring. The anticipation I felt reminded me of being in 7th grade, desperately waiting for Martin's news. My mom still had her heart set on Villanova. She felt like the 2 women on the international admission staff were the most sympathetic to Martin's story. Her new strategy was to focus on 1 school versus dozens. She started calling Villanova every week. Hi, Candace. Any news? My mom's chipper voice resonated through our house. Or, Valerie, it's Anne. I'm going to be on campus tomorrow and wondered if I could bring you lunch. She was working every single angle. The rejection letters came first. His SAT scores were likely the reason, though his personal essay was also a bit difficult to comprehend. He wrote about his dream of becoming an actuarial scientist, which I had never heard of until then. When I looked it up in our encyclopedia, I understood why. It was
A discipline that applies mathematical and statistical methods to assess risk in insurance and financial fields. The definition made my head hurt. I had just dropped a statistics class at college because the number problems looked like Mandarin. The form rejection from an Ivy League college made me angry. I wanted to scream, "You are making a huge mistake!" It infuriated me that Martin's fate was being determined in this cold and impersonal way. If any one of these college presidents could meet with him or correspond with him, they'd be begging for him to come to their school. They would feel lucky to get him. Some schools saw this and offered him partial scholarships. Temple was one, but we already ruled that out after seeing Wallace's difficult transition. Yale was another flat-out no. I knew Martin would receive all this news via email, and just wished I could be there when he did, to say, "This means nothing. They don't know you. Don't give up." The problem was, I was starting to. Especially when I heard my mom talking to Candace one afternoon in late April. "Are you certain?" she said, her voice cracking on the last word. I walked into the kitchen. "So, there's nothing else we can do," she added, her chin trembling. "Thank you, Candace. I know how hard you have been working on this." After she hung up, my mother looked despondent. "What is it?" I said. "That was Villanova," she said. "They have a spot for him, but no money." She could not hold the tears back any longer. "I failed, Martin," she said. "And you. I'm so sorry, honey." It was difficult to see my mother defeated. I wanted to comfort her somehow. This was not the end of the road. It couldn't be. "Mom, you have worked so hard to make this happen," I said. "We cannot give up now. There has to be a way." Mom just shook her head. "Have you heard back from Oprah?" I asked. I knew she had written her earlier that spring, trying to get Martin's story on Oprah's show to raise awareness, and hopefully funds, about his story. "No," my mom said, blowing her nose. "Or from Bill Gates or Bill Cosby." My mom had a file for every wealthy celebrity she had contacted, every organization that offered international scholarships, and every institution that might sponsor a brilliant kid from Africa. "We'll find another way," I said. "We can do a shoe drive or a bake sale. I can get sponsors and do a bike ride across America." I was on a roll. "Caitlin, you concentrate on your finals," my mother said, wiping tears from beneath both eyes. "I'll keep working on Martin."
May 2003. Martin. Upon my return home, I learned that Wallace was really struggling at school. His parents had written me a letter. They were so appreciative of my American family's help that they invited me to come stay with them in Victoria Falls while I waited for more news from the United States. I was happy to accept. There was nothing to do in Mutare beyond hustling at the market for spare change. Wallace's parents offered me a place to stay and a job helping them at the bed and breakfast. This meant I would have access to phones and the internet, which would help with securing a scholarship. It was a 2-day journey. The first stop was Harare, then Bulawayo, and finally Victoria Falls. The last leg of the trip was breathtaking as the train barreled up Zimbabwe's Western Corridor. It was nighttime when we passed through Hwange National Park, the largest game reserve in the country. I could see the silhouettes of the baobab trees rising above the grasslands in the moonlight, and then a sea of red dots that suddenly stood still before disappearing into the night. "Antelope," my seatmate said. We had baboons and other monkeys in Mutare, but we didn't have antelope or elephants or lions hanging around. I didn't blame these majestic animals for staying so far away from the cities. I kept on the lookout all night, hoping to spot one. No luck. Perhaps the sound of the engine scared them off. The sun had begun its rise as we pulled alongside the Zambezi River, which feeds the falls. Locally, we call them Musi or Atunya, which means the smoke that thunders. I saw the spray rising in the distance, a shimmering fog, and truly understood. I recognized Wallace's parents, Tekla and Fanuel, immediately. I saw Wallace in each of them. They were waiting for me at the station, and their accents were familiar as they come from the Eastern Highlands, like my family. I felt immediately at ease. We drove back to their house, which reminded me of the picture Caitlin sent me of hers. I was astonished by how humble Wallace's parents were, as it was clear they had great wealth. Tekla showed me my room and the bathroom. "I'll make sure to bathe early so as not to disturb you," I said. "That's not necessary," Tekla said. "We have our own bathroom. This is for your use." She then invited me downstairs for breakfast. I took my seat and was stunned when a maid entered the room with a platter of scrambled eggs. I said hello, and she bowed her head at me as she served me. I'd never been served by someone in this manner. It made me think of my mother, who had started doing this work in Mutare. I wanted to say, "I'm happy to serve myself," but I didn't want to cause a scene, so I kept quiet. She disappeared back into the kitchen and returned with cereal, tea, and orange juice, which I had never tasted before. It remains my favorite drink to this day. Tekla and Fanuel filled me in on Wallace's news. I did not know that he had moved in with Caitlin's family for a while, or that Anne and Rich had helped him find a new apartment with a much nicer roommate to finish his freshman year with. "Anne treats Wallace like her own son," Tekla said. "We'll never know how to repay her kindness." "I feel the same," I said. "This family is the reason I'm sitting here with you." Fanuel asked about my own college news, and I told them I was still waiting for a scholarship. "Anne and I speak often," Tekla said. "She's determined to find one." "And from what she tells us, so are you," Fanuel said. I was determined, and I really had to be, as I had not made any other alternative plans. Optimism was key. If I doubted now, even for a moment, I would never get to the United States. We finished eating, and I went to unpack. I had only brought a few things. The three shirts Caitlin had sent me over the years, my dungarees, cargo shorts, and fila sneakers. As I hung things up in my closet, I saw that every item of clothing I owned came from Caitlin. Somehow, they gave me hope. I showered and then changed into fresh clothes. Tekla was waiting for me downstairs to take me to the falls. As we approached the national park, I heard a dull roar. It sounded like an army of angels clapping. We pulled into the parking lot, which was thronged with mostly white tourists. From there, we walked down a dirt path to the first viewpoint. The ground beneath my feet trembled so much, I could feel the vibration in my teeth. Soon, a damp spray was enveloping me. It moistened my skin and turned trapped sunlight into soft rainbows. The vegetation became more lush and vibrant green as we neared the first gorge. The sound was deafening by the time we reached the cliff's edge, and I finally saw why. The cascade of water was so vast and mighty, I thought the angels were not only clapping, they were giving a standing and stomping ovation for a spectacle only God could have created. From there, Tekla took me to the bed and breakfast a kilometer away and introduced me to the staff as the new receptionist. My job was to greet and check guests in, and then help with any travel requests. My first day, I met two Americans, four Australians, and a group of people from the United Kingdom who had arrived on a tour bus. Victoria Falls is a must-see stop on any Zimbabwe package tour. Tourists would stay for 2 days before heading down to Hwange. I'd never seen so many white people in my life. I told everyone I met about Caitlin. At the bed and breakfast, there was a computer connected to the internet, so I was able to communicate with Caitlin and Anne frequently, though there wasn't much news. Waiting was quite painful. In the meantime, I read an ad in the newspaper about a pre-departure orientation for Zimbabwean students who were planning to study in America. It was taking place at the U.S. Embassy in early June. I called the number listed and spoke to a woman called Rebecca Mano. I told her I was very interested in the orientation, but wasn't sure if I'd be going to college that September.